The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 12/April 19, 2021. It has the usual red band on all four sides of its cover, with Time in large bold print in white superimposed upon the cover photograph, which today is of a young woman of color, perhaps a teenager. She has long, curly hair. She's wearing black jeans that are, I think, called distressed at the knee, a black and white shirt underneath a blue denim jacket. She's seated on a bench, on either side of which are lockers, perhaps in her school. And she's holding a couple of books. They're not books. One's a book, but the title is not clear because her hands are covering it. And the other looks like a laptop computer. And both of those are on her lap, and she's clasping them with her hands. She's looking askance from the camera. The background here is a blue-gray behind the Time imprint, and the lockers look kind of like a beige-gray in an institutional setting. That photo for Time was taken by Mohammed Sadek, or Sadek. For the record, we are just almost there, but not quite yet, stated by Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, saying she has a sense of impending doom over a possible fourth COVID-19 wave in the U.S. and urging Americans to continue following public health guidelines at a White House press briefing March 29. I know we promised to die with the secret, but this will open doors for many other queer people to simply exist. From Lil Nas X. In a March 26 open letter to his younger self, promoting the release of his new single, Montero, M-O-N-T-E-R-O, Call Me By Your Name. If folks don't want to visit a donut shop, they don't have to. Mike Tattersfield, Krispy Kreme CEO, in a March 27 interview responding to criticism of the fast food chain's announcement that it would give one free donut per day to anyone showing proof of COVID-19 vaccination. No one can take a drop from Egypt's water. And if it happens, there will be inconceivable stability in the region. Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, president of Egypt, raising concerns March 30 that a massive dam being built by Ethiopia on the Blue Nile could impact Egypt's water supply. When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, I look at how that could have been one of them. Darnella Frazier, the teen who filmed viral video of Floyd's death, testifying March 30 at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who is charged with murdering Floyd. 2.8 weight in tons. In award-winning artisanal cheese that a group of French monks are now attempting to sell online after COVID-19 lockdowns meant fewer visitors to their monastery's shop. Good news of the week. The U.S. bald eagle population has grown fourfold in the past decade, according to a March 24 report from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. 47% percentage of Americans who report belonging to a church, synagogue, or mosque, according to a new Gallup survey analysis released March 29, the first time in 8 decades that Gallup data has shown membership dropping below the majority. The brief opener, politics after huge 2020 turnout, GOP moves to restrict voting, by Sonia Mansour. Moments after Governor Brian Kemp signed a sweeping overhaul of Georgia's election law, State Representative Park Cannon, a Democrat, knocked on the door of his office. Kemp was making an official inside and law making an announcement inside, and law enforcement officials told Cannon to stop. She continued and was swiftly dragged down a corridor of the state capitol by 2 Georgia State Patrol officers. All we asked is for her to be able to see Kemp sign a bill that is signing our rights away, State Representative Erica Thomas, a Democrat who watched Cannon's arrest, said in a video posted on Instagram, and you arrested her. What Kemp was signing March 25 was among the first in a spate of new restrictions on voting, igniting a political battle over the future of voting rights in the country. Republicans in Georgia say the new law is necessary to preserve election integrity, restore public confidence in voting, and root out fraud that election officials say exists almost entirely in the minds of losing candidates. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has repeatedly said there was no widespread fraud in the state's elections. The law strengthens voter ID requirements for absentee ballots and imposes new limits on drop boxes, offering food or drink to voters in line, and more. Democrats and voting rights advocates say this amounts to a thinly veiled attempt to suppress turnout after last year's elections, and will make it harder for black and other minority voters, as well as poor and disabled Georgians, to cast ballots. They call it a blueprint for a broader strategy to roll back voting rights in GOP-controlled state legislatures across the country. It is sick and un-American what they're doing, and it cannot stand, President Joe Biden said of the Republican efforts to restrict voting in dozens of states. Describing the new Georgia law's likely disproportionate impact on minority voters as Jim Crow in the 21st century, he said the Justice Department is taking a look at what the federal government can do to blunt the law, and urged Congress to pass a Democrat-sponsored voting rights bill currently before the Senate. Democratic lawyer Mark Elias, the Georgia NAACP, and voting rights groups have already filed lawsuits challenging the law. It is not a coincidence that Georgia is at the center of this fight. Voting rights advocates in the state have worked for years to get out the vote among underrepresented communities. Their campaign helped drive record turnout in recent elections. It also coincided with a major electoral defeat for Republicans. Biden flipped the state blue for the first time in decades, and 2 Democratic newcomers unseated the state's incumbent GOP senators in subsequent runoff elections. But Georgia's not the only state where Republicans, in the wake of 2020's record turnout, are moving to restrict voting. As of February 19, lawmakers were pushing 253 bills that could restrict voter access in 43 states, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit researching democracy. There are also several hundred bills that seek to increase voting access, and legislatures in New Jersey and Kentucky have recently passed measures expanding early voting. Many of the restrictive proposals target early and mail voting in other battleground states like Arizona, Florida, and Texas. Some of these efforts fall in line with broader conservative messaging. The Heritage Foundation recommends states improve election integrity by pushing policies to root out fraud, particularly through strict voter ID requirements. The Republican State Leadership Committee, the GOP's election arm for state legislature and Secretary of State races, is coordinating what it calls a national effort to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. Democrats in state legislatures across the country are looking to Congress for ways to fight back. A comprehensive voting bill, including requirements for states to automatically register eligible voters, restore voting rights of formerly incarcerated citizens, and allow no excuse absentee balloting, among dozens of other measures, passed the House March 3. But the bill is unlikely to pass the divided Senate, where it would require 60 votes without filibuster reform. And even then, it is not yet clear whether all 50 Democratic votes in the upper chamber are on board. Carol Anderson, chair of African American Studies at Emory University in Atlanta and author of One Person, No Vote, says the U.S. has been here before. She compares the Georgia law and other proposed bills around the country to attempts in the late 19th century to disenfranchise black voters that relied on an array of policies that were designed and that worked together. If the poll tax did not get you, the literacy test would, Anderson says. If the literacy test did not get you, then the good character clause would. It's a web. The writer of this article, Sonia Mansour, had a reporting also by Brian Bennett of Washington. News ticker. Three short items here. Mexico police under fire over custody death. Protests in Mexico and El Salvador have followed the March 27 death of Victoria Salazar in Tulum. Authorities have confirmed Salazar, a Salvadoran woman, died of a broken neck while in police custody. The Quintana Roo state prosecutor said his office is preparing femicide charges against four officers involved in her arrest. GOP representative in sex crime investigation, the Department of Justice, is investigating whether Republican Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, that's G-A-E-T-Z, violated federal sex trafficking laws over an alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl, the New York Times reported March 30. Gaetz has strongly denied the charges. Jailed Kremlin critic declares hunger strike. Imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny said in a March 31 Instagram post published by his lawyers that he will be on a hunger strike until the prison where he's being held provides him with medical treatment. Navalny also alleged he's been denied sufficient sleep. Well, here's an interesting photo. The background is a blue sky with some white clouds, just as one might see here in North Carolina. But it's a statue. It's a very large statue with the head facing away, mostly away from the camera. It's shrouded. The head is shrouded in some kind of a cloth, although this is a statue. But popping out from what would be the shoulder of this character or person is a white-helmeted woman, and she's looking askance also, not quite at the same angle the statue is facing, but she's looking over her shoulder toward the sky. It's a touch-up. Christina Ventura, an architect, heading up restoration and repair of Rio de Janeiro's Cristo Redentor looks out from atop the 125-foot-tall statue, March 24. The iconic Art Deco figure, completed in 1931, is undergoing touch-ups in preparation for its 90th birthday in October. More than 40 people, including engineers, geologists, architects, are working on the monument situated on the peak of Brazil's Mount Corcovado, Reuters reports. And I will say that the face of this statue is bearded. Again, it's looking at an angle approximately, I'd say, 120 degrees away from the camera. Equality, trans rights in the spotlight as U.S. states pass discriminatory bills. This article is by Suyin Haynes. As March 31 marked the annual Transgender Day of Visibility, LGBTQ advocates in the U.S. warned a flurry of legislation targeting access to gender-affirming health care and sports participation for young transgender people will have significant and harmful effects. Over 100 bills attacking transgender people have been introduced in state legislatures since 2020, according to the ACLU, with over 60 currently in consideration across the country. Healthcare bans. March 29, the Arkansas Senate passed a bill that would ban access to gender-affirming healthcare for transgender youth. If signed into law by Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson, the state would be the first to ban such access. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice at the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project, called it the single most extreme anti-trans law to ever pass through a state legislature. Similar bills are advancing through state legislatures in Tennessee and Alabama, the latter of which would ban health care for transgender youth up to 19 years old and include felony penalties for medical practitioners. Anti-trans sports bills. Simply a politically motivated bill for the sake of discrimination itself, said Alfonso David, president of the Human Rights Campaign of another anti-trans bill Governor Hutchinson signed into law March 25, banning transgender women and girls from participating in sports consistent with their gender identity in Arkansas. Governors in Mississippi and Tennessee have both signed similar bills into law in March, and South Dakota's Governor Kristi Noem issued executive orders to an equivalent effect March 29. Equality Act. The spate of anti-trans bills comes amid broader national conversations on transgender equality. February 25, the Democratic-led House of Representatives passed the Equality Act, which extends civil rights protections on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. But its fate in the Senate is far less certain. And while the Senate confirmed Dr. Rachel Levine as the first ever openly trans federal official March 24, her confirmation hearings were peppered with transphobic comments and misinformation from Kentucky's Republican Senator Rand Paul. Three more short items from the brief news ticker. Thousands flee Myanmar airstrikes. Myanmar's military junta announced a month-long ceasefire March 31, accepting incidents that could impact its government after days of airstrikes forced thousands to flee into neighboring Thailand. Protests continue against the February 1 coup. Security forces have killed over 500 people. WHO, WHO, report posits source of COVID-19. The World Health Organization, WHO, released a report March 30 suggesting animal to human transmission, perhaps at wildlife farms, as the likely source of early COVID-19 cases near Wuhan, China, but said more research is needed. It also said the possibility the virus emerged from a laboratory leak was extremely unlikely. Eurovision Song Contest bans Belarus. Belarus was disqualified from the 2021 Eurovision Song Contest, March 26, over a rules breach after lyrics in two songs submitted by the would-be performers, such as "I Will Teach You to Toe the Line," were seen as critical of anti-government protesters. Good question. Will Amazon workers ignite a labor union revolution? This is by Abby Vesoulis. In the sleepy southern town of Bessemer, Alabama, a brigade of Amazon warehouse workers has challenged one of the largest retail organizations in the world to a unionization battle. If a simple majority of the roughly 6,000 workers have voted for the retail, wholesale, and department store union, RWDSU, to represent them by the March 29 deadline, they will be the first group of Amazon employees to form a union in the U.S. after several failed attempts at other plants. While the RWDSU faced an uphill battle before voting started, Amazon organized mandatory anti-union meetings at the warehouse. A vote for unionization could spur more workers at the company and beyond to seek bargaining power, marking an increase in private sector union membership that's been in decline for decades. If the vote fails, it could stifle future attempts to unionize. Unlike in many labor battles, the central issue is not just money. At Amazon's warehouses, workers make at least $15 per hour plus benefits. That rate is more than twice the federal minimum wage, while in Bessemer, the median annual income is about $18,000. Instead, the fight's about control and demands on worker efficiency. Some employees believe they do not need representation. J.C. Thompson, a supervisor, says Amazon warehouse workers are paid and treated fairly for their work. But other workers say they need a union on their side. They want wages commensurate with Amazon's profits. Safety on the job during a pandemic that's infected thousands of Amazon workers nationwide, and to be treated like human beings. Daryl Richardson, 51, a warehouse worker leading the charge, says he was drawn to unionizing after being approached by a supervisor for spending too much time in the restroom. "I feel like we're a number. We're robots," he says. A union could help workers bargain for more breaks and clearer policies. Amazon says it has every right to monitor employee productivity. "We have performance expectations for every Amazonian, be it corporate employees or fulfillment center associates. And we measure actual performance against those expectations," says spokesperson Heather Knox. The company declined to comment on the record on Richardson's allegation. But labor advocates hope the Bessemer plant's fight could spark a resurgence in private sector labor unions, especially with a pro-union president and a Democratic-led Congress. Public support's also growing. According to a September 2020 Gallup report, 65% of Americans approved of labor unions, the highest number in nearly two decades. "There's a chance for this to be a big moment for the future of labor unions," says David Madland of the Center for American Progress. "This could be the start of a big growth spurt." Milestones. Died G. Gordon Liddy, Watergate planner. This short column is written by Olivia B. Waxman. One could argue that G. Gordon Liddy, who died March 30 at 90, was always ruthless. According to an oft-repeated anecdote from his childhood, he once ate a rat dragged in by his sister's cat. to demonstrate to myself my lack of fear. 30 years later, while serving in Richard Nixon's administration, the lawyer was a member of the White House Plumbers, a secret unit tasked with doing whatever it took to stop leaks, a job that led to a role in the Watergate burglary that eventually brought about Nixon's 1974 resignation. Liddy's refusal to testify led to his serving the longest prison term of any of the scandal's persona. But after getting out, he had no problem talking, moving into a lucrative speaking career. Perhaps more than any of the Watergate characters, Time observed of the unrepentant tone of his best-selling 1980 memoir, Liddy embodied the principles underlying the scandal that destroyed a president. He did what had to be done, he seemed to suggest, and there was to him, despite everything, no shame in that. Continuing with milestones, Jessica Walter died, Arresting Actor by Aaliyah Shawkat. There's a photo here of a rather glamorous woman wearing a black skirt, white blouse, bright red jacket. Her hair is reddish brown. She's wearing a strand or two of pearls around her neck. She has brown eyes, bright red lipstick. She's holding a pair of glasses in her left hand. Her right hand is lounging on a large overstuffed cushion on a large overstuffed brocade couch in tones of beige and tan. The background shows a patterned, perhaps Grecian or Roman or Egyptian motif, red and white wall, and there's the bottom of a gold frame visible as if a painting were hanging above her. She is not smiling in this photograph. Jessica Walter would love to know that she remained a meme sensation even after she passed. It goes to show what a powerhouse she really was, that she could connect to younger generations late in her career. An award-winning actor who starred in Clint Eastwood's directorial debut, Play Misty for Me, and voiced Spy Chief Mallory Archer in the cult classic animated sitcom Archer, among other roles. Walter, who died March 24 at 80, was perhaps most beloved for her role as perennially tipsy matriarch Lucille Bluth in Arrested Development. The writing on Arrested Development was top-notch, but her delivery was incredible. Jessica was an actor's actor and the core of the show. As with any dysfunctional family, after all, the behavior patterns usually stem from the mother. I started filming Arrested Development when I was 14. When I returned for later seasons, I always wanted to prove I was an adult. Even though I'd done lots of indie movies and was working on my own show, Search Party, I still felt slightly intimidated, but Jessica was like that grandma who's always hyping you up. "You all know what Aaliyah has been up to, right?" she'd say in the hair and makeup trailer and loudly. "She's starring in her own show. She's brilliant. I hope I get to work on a project so groundbreaking later in life, let alone become its strongest selling point. If I could really give it my all at that stage in the game, then I would know that I'm doing it right." This was by Aaliyah Shawkat as told to Sonia Mansour. Shawkat is, or Shawkat, S-H-A-W-K-A-T, is an actor and Walter's former Arrested Development co-star. And another column indicating someone who died, Beverly Cleary, A Voice for Kids. This is by Jenny Hahn. And there's a small inset photo of a smiling, gray-haired lady. Her chin is resting on her clasped hands, and her hair is grayish on the dark side of gray. She's wearing glasses, and her eyes are all crinkled and squinted up as if she's thinking of something funny or someone has just said something funny. She has a little smirky grin on her face. Hahn, the writer of this little article, is best-selling author of To All the Boys I've Loved Before and The Summer I Turned Pretty, trilogies. One Beverly Cleary scene I will never forget comes in her book Ramona and Her Mother from her beloved Ramona series. Ramona's parents get into a huge fight after one of them forgets to turn on the crock pot. Ramona's tummy hurts as she watches them argue, and she worries they will divorce. That night she sleeps in her big sister Beza's bed, and they comfort each other. When I read that as a child, it brought me great comfort, too. Other kids' parents fight, and it turns out all right. A Newbery Medal-winning author of over 40 books, Cleary, who died March 25 at the age of 104, wrote about children's fears in a way that honored them in the moment, but she also let you know they would pass. In the morning, things would look different. She captured children's inner worlds, crafting extraordinary narratives out of ordinary lives. Cleary's very name now conjures up a specific kind of magic for readers of all ages. It presses on that soft spot, not only of books you read and loved as a kid, but an ache for childhood itself. More milestones here in very brief format. Died famed Egyptian feminist author and women's rights activist Nawal El Saadawi at 89, March 21. Pulitzer Prize and Oscar-winning author and screenwriter Larry McMurtry at 84, March 25. Sarah Obama, step-grandmother of former President Barack Obama at 99, March 29. Peaked Japan's cherry blossom season in Kyoto, March 26, the earliest date in the 1,200 years the season's been recorded, according to Osaka University. Sued former President Trump by two Capitol police officers on duty during the January 6 Capitol riot. The officers argue Trump is responsible for physical and emotional damages. Fined French pharmaceutical giant Servier a total of 2.7 million euros after being found guilty of covering up potentially fatal side effects of a popular weight loss drug. Frozen, the Facebook page of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro for 30 days after he asserted without evidence that an herbal remedy can cure COVID-19. Updated, an overhaul of Monopoly's community chest cards to better reflect what community means to people today. Toy company Hasbro announced March 18. The Brief Nation, a breaking point for Atlanta's Asian businesses by Sonia Mansour and Andrew R. Chow. Tip, that's T-H-I-P. Atakhan, A-T-H-A-K-H-A-N-H, says her approach to facing racism used to be shrug it off, be silent, and continue to move forward. A chef who owns the Lau restaurant Snack Box Bistro in Doraville, Georgia, just outside Atlanta. Atakhan typically took the name-calling and condescension she would occasionally receive in stride and avoided publicly voicing her opinion on issues related to anti-Asian hate out of fear of retaliation that could harm her business or employees' livelihoods. But the March 16 spa shootings, in which a gunman attacked three Atlanta-area businesses, killing eight people, six of them Asian women, transformed her perspective. It was an agonizing feeling, Atakhan says. Those victims could have been my mother, my sister, my friend. Following the shootings, Atakhan took actions, both personal and communal. She brought a gun to her restaurant for the first time in years and bought mace for female employees. She also provided refreshments at a March 20 solidarity rally in Atlanta and helped organizing a fundraising initiative with other Asian women-owned businesses, selling meal boxes with 100% of proceeds going to victims' families. Across the metro Atlanta area, many other Asian American business owners are now grappling with how to move forward. The past year has seen both a sharp decline in their businesses, driven by the COVID-19 pandemic, and a steep rise in violence against Asian Americans, one of the fastest-growing populations in the region. The number of Asian Americans in suburban Gwinnett County more than doubled between 2000 and 2020, per the New York Times. The population across Greater Atlanta is diverse ethnically, with Indian, Vietnamese, Chinese, and Korean communities, as well as economically. Many residents run or work at family-run establishments like restaurants, nail salons, spas, and greengrocers. Asian Americans meeting the public in such service industry jobs are extra vulnerable to racist mistreatment. Business owners say these dynamics have worsened during the pandemic, as xenophobic language that emphasizes the coronavirus's origins has been spread by those in positions of power, including former President Trump, who repeatedly called the coronavirus the Chinese virus or Kung Flu. Cheng Hsia, whose family has owned the Chinese restaurant Yen Jing in Doraville for 3 decades, says they've received phone calls over the past year asking if they served bat soup or had the virus. One person asked, while in the restaurant, "Why do we have to wear a mask when you guys brought it over?" Mi Ling Cao, CAO, who owns Dua, Vietnamese noodle soup, close to the city center, says that name-calling and suspicious looks have been part of her life since she arrived in the U.S. as a 17-month-old refugee of the Vietnam War, including at her restaurant. In one incident, she says 2 customers became incensed when she refused them a refund on their mostly eaten meals. "There was a lot of name-calling, calling me an Asian bitch," she says, saying, "Go back where you came from." Other patrons did nothing to intervene, Cao adds. For many Asian Americans, the shootings were a tipping point, causing them to think differently about racism and responding to it. "We tend to not speak of what we're going through. Maybe it is just within our culture," Trung, a co-owner of Nails Couture in Griffin, Georgia, says. "We should stand up and speak." Atakan recalls an encounter she had in Alabama as a child when a man shouted a racial slur at her and her father. "My father said, 'Thank you.' He's a very smart man. I know he knows what those words meant, but he chose to ignore it, mind his business, and keep going," she says. "That was the mentality I had growing up, but I think times have changed for us. I think we reached our breaking point." This article was written by Sonia Mansour and Andrew R. Chow, with reporting by Erica Lee, Ann Most, and Francesca Triani, New York. The Brief Health, The Psychology of Influence by Jeffrey Kluger, Kluger. One of evolution's cleverest tricks was giving us a sense of shame. It is a miserable feeling, low, humbling, publicly discomforting, but it is supposed to be. If you do something lousy, you ought to feel something lousy, so you don't do it again. In theory, when so many of the strategies for beating the COVID-19 pandemic depend on abiding by social distancing and other rules, shaming people who don't ought to be a powerful way to bring us back in line. But increasingly, experts believe the opposite's true. The thinking has been that the more you shame people, the more they'll obey, says Giovanni Travolino, an assistant professor of social psychology at Kent University. But this turns out to be absolutely wrong. Last month, Travolino and Chung Ki Moon, an assistant professor of psychology at Leeds Beckett University, published a paper in Frontiers in Psychology that threw the ineffectiveness of shaming into relief. they assembled nearly 1,900 people from the U.S., Italy, and South Korea, choosing those countries on the basis of their differing sense of the collective culture, with the U.S. judge the most individualistic, South Korea the most group-oriented, and Italy in between. The subjects were asked to rate how ashamed or guilty they would feel if they contracted COVID-19. They were also asked to rate how often they obey guidelines, like social distancing, and how likely they would be to tell friends, acquaintances, and health authorities if they tested positive. In all three countries, the higher the level of shame and guilt people felt over falling ill, the less likely they were to play it safe and to report their COVID-19 status. In the U.S. and elsewhere, the anti-vaccine movement has long been a threat to public health, and many pro-vaccine messages have been designed to shame adherence. A December story in the U.K.'s Metro featured the headline, "People Think Anti-Vaxxers Are Stupid and Selfish." Attention-grabbing maybe, but counterproductive. It is hard to get people to act in a cooperative manner when you approach them that way, says Travolino. It is associated with subordination to authority, and people don't like that. A new Time Harris Poll survey similarly suggests individual authority figures are not very effective at convincing vaccine skeptics. Of U.S. adults who had recently been vaccinated, only 32% said they were influenced by a local official reaching out directly by email, phone, or mail. Much more effective, it seems, are appeals to people's individual needs and desires. Some 52% of those polled said they got the vaccine because they wanted to travel, for example. The people around us also play a major role, with 56% of respondents saying they got vaccinated after a friend or family member did, and 59% saying they were influenced merely by having a conversation with such a closely connected person. And despite our ostensible mistrust in the media, 63% said they were influenced by news reports about people who had already been vaccinated. Indeed, past research shows value in appealing to us through personal stories. In a 2015 study published in the PNAS, volunteers took a survey on their attitudes about vaccines and were then divided into three groups, each one given one of three things to read: material showing that autism and vaccines are not related, a paragraph of a mother describing her child's bout with measles, and material on an unrelated science topic. When the subjects took the vaccine survey again, all were more pro-vaccine than before, but the ones who read the mother's account were dramatically more so, with an increase 5 times as great as that of the group that had read the material on autism, and 6 times that of the control group. Personal accounts can have a negative impact, too. A new study published in PLOS One, that's PLOS1, by researchers from the University of Illinois and the Annenberg Public Policy Center, found that subjects who saw a video clip of Dr. Anthony Fauci talking about the safety and effectiveness of the measles vaccine came away from it more favorably disposed to vaccination overall. But the positive effect was diminished when they saw another video clip first of a mother describing the severe rash one of her children developed after receiving the vaccine. The solution, the paper concluded, is not for the media to censor such accounts, but to precede them with real-world data on the minimal risks and the considerable benefits of vaccines. What does not work, clearly, is pointing fingers and casting blame and shame. It is the virus that is the enemy, after all, not the people it infects. The brief time with Representative Pramila Jayapal is pushing Joe Biden to be more progressive. by Abigail Abrams. And Pramila is pronounced P-R-A, or it's spelled, excuse me, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, P-R-A-M-I-L-A, and again, I hope I'm pronouncing Jayapal correctly, J-A-Y-A-P-A-L. Representative Pramila Jayapal looks solemn. She is one of the top leaders of the progressive movement in Congress, and she is poised to finally effect change in a Democrat-controlled government after a decade of the party's sharing power with Republicans. But right now, she is in no mood to celebrate. After the passage of the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package in mid-March, Jayapal was preparing to reintroduce her Medicare for All Act when, the afternoon before her announcement, a shooter killed 8 people, including 6 women of Asian descent, near Atlanta, and reignited a national conversation about racism, sexism, and violence against Asian Americans. When we spoke by Zoom on March 19, Jayapal had just come from a moment of silence on the House floor for the victims. "It has been very tough," she says, settling into a chair in her office with a sigh. And also, not surprising. The situation is, in some ways, devastatingly familiar to the Congresswoman. Jayapal, 55, who was born in India and came to the U.S. to attend college at Georgetown, got her start in politics as an activist in Seattle, advocating for immigrants who experienced discrimination after the September 11 terrorist attacks. She built the largest immigration rights organization in Washington state, formed diverse coalitions, and sued George W. Bush's administration over its deportation of Somali immigrants. She has said experience taught her that even tragedies can be opportunities for change. But after years of agitating from the outside, Jayapal is a bona fide insider. After 2 years in the Washington State Senate, she was elected to Congress in 2016 and spent her first years fighting President Donald Trump at every turn. Now as the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, she's one of the most influential officials of the Democrats' left flank, and she's become a primary conduit between President Joe Biden and those in his party who think he is an overly cautious centrist. Her journey from activist to powerful legislator was aided by an approach that melds progressive beliefs with pragmatic style, a combination that's won her respect from both Democratic camps. But legislating in a government under unified Democratic control is a more nuanced project than pushing for ambitious proposals from the outside, or even from the minority party. Jayapal's continued influence in D.C. depends on her ability to convince her caucus that compromise and incremental gains can sometimes be the best way forward, and on her success at making that true. "Governing is different than opposing," she says, and I think we're all getting used to the idea that we are governing. The central question for Jayapal and the left is how far Biden's willing to go. Biden does not support Medicare for All, which is one of Jayapal's signature policies, and he's more moderate on most economic issues than Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, whom Jayapal endorsed in the presidential primary. Nor does Biden so far support eliminating the filibuster, the Senate rule that effectively requires 60 votes to pass most legislation, which Jayapal and other progressives want to scrap. But Jayapal says she's never been interested in replicating the antagonistic relationship between the right-wing House Freedom Caucus and Republican leadership that divided the GOP starting in 2015. Instead of acting as an opposition arm, she says she wants to be a proposition one, proposing the most progressive ideas possible and framing them in ways that can persuade her colleagues and the president to support them. She says that model worked for Biden's COVID-19 relief legislation. The American Rescue Plan looked a lot like what progressive members wanted, and Biden got there in part because of the careful negotiating by people like Jayapal. Throughout the process, Jayapal kept in close contact with House and Senate leadership, and her team spoke to the White House Legislative Affairs staff almost daily, she says. When a $15 minimum wage increase fell out of the package because of Senate rules, some Democrats considered withholding their votes entirely. Jayapal helped persuade those members to support the deal, and it passed almost entirely along party lines. Progressives have been sort of pushed to the margins so often in politics that I think we may have gotten used to that, Jayapal says. And so people are very inclined to say, oh, this happened again, we didn't get everything we wanted. But she taught her colleagues to realize we should take the win. It is the strategy Jayapal plans to pursue on other policies, while still trying to bring Biden further left behind the scenes. Biden called Jayapal after the relief package passed to thank her for her help, she says. And while she thanked him for his leadership on the law in return, she also told him she still wants to see the minimum wage increased. As Democrats begin to craft major infrastructure legislation, Jayapal plans to advocate for policies that will invest in America's poorest communities. The rescue package was taking on decades of neoliberal thinking, she says, and she hopes it will show Americans the federal government should provide more equal opportunities for all. Biden unveiled his infrastructure proposal March 31. And before that, Jayapal and a small group of other progressive lawmakers met with the White House twice to talk strategy, she says. She wants the next bills to combat climate change, invest in child care and paid leave policies, and take aim at prescription drug costs. But the plan's already more contentious than COVID-19 relief, and to be effective, Jayapal says progressives will need to focus on a limited number of what she calls popular and populist priorities. Healthcare is an important area to Jayapal. She co-chaired the Healthcare Unity Task Force that Biden and Sanders established last summer, and she wants Biden to adopt the proposals they agreed to, including lowering the Medicare eligibility age and adding aggressive drug pricing powers. I have raised it now to everyone that I've had the opportunity to speak with, she says, chuckling. But Jayapal has learned she cannot always hold out for the purest solution, the way she would have in her activist days. She knows Medicare for All is not close to passing Congress, so she's focused on getting what she calls foundational elements, such as creating long-term care jobs and expanding Medicare eligibility into other bills while holding hearings on the larger plan. I'm an immigrant woman, and I've spent my life working on civil rights, she says, so I feel a responsibility to do whatever I can to get people health care quickly. She knows none of her goals is going to be easy to accomplish, and time is short, with Republicans gunning to take back the House in 2022. But she's energized, and during difficult days, she draws on the lessons from those early years of her career defending immigrant rights. As she pushes Biden to accept the left's agenda piece by piece, she wants progressives to never, ever let that undermine our ability to create the tipping point at which real change becomes possible, she says. That's an organizer's mentality. You never give up an opportunity to really build the movement so that when that tipping point comes, you are ready. There's a photograph here of Representative Pramila Jayapal. It's just her shoulders and head, but we see a woman with a tan face, pink lipstick, dark brown eyes, dark brown to black hair, straight, shoulder length. She's wearing a bright red jacket over a black top. She's looking almost in profile, away from the camera. From the larger column, Time Off Books, I'll read to you a few excerpts until our time is over. More of April's best books. This column is written by Annabelle Guterman. She lists six titles, and I'll see how many I can read to you in a couple of minutes. White Magic, 10 Interconnected Essays Make Up Elissa Washuta's Bruising New Nonfiction Collection. In them, the author, who's a member of the Cowlitz Indian tribe, that's C-O-W-L-I-T-Z, unveils her efforts at healing after years of struggling with sobriety, PTSD, and a misdiagnosis of bipolar disorder. She asks haunting questions about intoxication, love, grief, and more, all while interspersing references to the pop culture that's informed her life, from Twin Peaks to Stevie Nicks. These are seemingly disparate threads, but Washuta, that's W-A-S-H-U-T-A, ties them all back to her quest to understand the impact of all that she has endured. I'm Waiting for You and Other Stories, the two sets of paired stories in Kim Bo Young's new translated work of speculative fiction confront life's biggest questions. How long can love endure? Who decides what makes a person good or bad? And is there really such a thing as free will? But these are heavy topics, and Kim tackles them with playful prose and a creative eye. Her narratives, which are set in the future, drive us to reconsider our present and all that we take for granted. And that's Kim, B-O-Y-O-U-N-G. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.